Welcome to the FemiPod. These are conversations about females for everyone to listen to, learn from, and engage with. Brought to you by your Femi founders, Esther Kewen, and myself, Lydia O'Donnell. Welcome back to the FemiPod. I am here with Est, and this week we have one of the most exciting guests we have had to date. This week we are joined by Catherine Switzer, who needs no introduction, but we're going to give it anyway. Catherine was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon in 1967, when at the time, women running marathons was unheard of. While running the marathon, the race director approached Catherine with anger and attempted to pull her off the course. Catherine, as the strong woman she is, not only went on to complete the Boston Marathon in 1967, she also completed 40 marathons since, including winning the New York Marathon in 74, and has been a huge advocate for women's running ever since. Catherine founded 261 Fearless, a global women's running network, empowering women to run something we are obviously so passionate about at Femi. Catherine would have no idea the impact she has had on us, but we truly believe Catherine, alongside some other incredible female runners in the 60s and 70s, paved the way for us, both as female athletes and then also for us providing women with equal opportunity in the sport, which has led us here today building Femi, a community for women runners. Catherine, welcome to the pod. How are you?
I'm well. I'm really well. Thank you, Lydia, and thank you, Esther, for having me. This is so great. I'm delighted to be in my second home, or my half home, which is New Zealand. We'll talk a little bit about that. But to, I believe this is really one of my first podcasts directly to Antipodean women. And unless you're going global with it, which is okay with me, but it's wonderful to be here. So thank you.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah, we're so excited to speak to you and so honored to have you on the FemiPod. Let's go way back to the start. When you were younger and when women weren't really running or encouraged to play sport as much, what were you like as a young girl, and how did you end up finding that you had this passion for running?
Well, it was interesting. I was a girly girl. I played with dolls and all that kind of stuff, but I really loved playing with the boys more because they ran and they built forts and they jumped out of trees and all of those things I could do. But afterwards, I still liked going back to home and putting on a dress and playing with my dolls. So I didn't understand why you had to be one or the other. I mean, I believed you could be anything you wanted to be. And I think my life changed when I was 12. I was very young. I was always a year ahead. My parents started me in school when I was 5 rather than 6, and I could never catch up. So at 12, I found myself entering high school the next year. And I was prepubescent, still playing with dolls. But I realized that the women who were really girls, who were really popular, were cheerleaders, you know. They get to go out with the captain of the football team, and everybody cheered for them and everything. So I told my dad at dinner one night, my dad was a very imposing 6'5" Army colonel, that I wanted to be a cheerleader when I went to high school the next autumn, because I just graduated from elementary school. And he said, "You don't want to be a cheerleader. Cheerleaders cheer for other people. You want people to cheer for you." And he said, "You know, the game's on the field, not on the sidelines." You know, I did one of those. And he said, I said, "Well, what should I do?" And he said, "Your school is lucky enough to have for the first time something called field hockey. And I don't know what it is. I only know they run and the girls are going to play. And you should make that team." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I have not an idea what this school board is all about." And he said, "Well, look, if you ran a mile a day, a little, you know, a little over a kilometer, you'd be the best player on the team." He was highly motivational. And I said, "I couldn't possibly run a mile." And he said, "Sure you can." And then we helped me measure off the garden, you know, it was 7 laps, and we did it, made a math question out of it, you know. And so he said, "Come on, let's go. You can do it right now." And I said, "Right now?" And he said, "Yeah, right now." So we went out and I started off zooming, right? And he said, no, really take it easy. You want to make sure you can finish 7 laps. Let's do it. Anyway, I did it. I was so excited. I ran a mile. And I said, "Dad, I did it. I did it." And he said, "Yeah. Now you have to do it every day." He said, "What?" every day. He said, you know, no excuses, rain, snow, sleet, hot. It was very hot weather. It was in Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. And so I trained. I mean, I just did every day. I didn't want to miss that mind. I wanted to make the team. And it was really weird, you know, how you learn that some days are easy and others are impossible. No rhyme or reason, but you have to do it anyway. And pretty soon, it wasn't even the run that was getting me out there. It was a sense of accomplishment and empowerment. And for a little girl entering high school with 1,500, you know, grown-up kids, it was amazing. So it was that, and I made the team. I was one of the best players. And I had a great team, and I still went home and played dolls, but I but it was that. And then the miles got longer, and eventually I got to, when I went to Syracuse University, I was up to 3 miles a day, which I thought nobody ever did more than that. And then I asked the coach of the cross country team if I could run on the men's team, because they didn't have any women's sports at the university, if you can imagine. 25 for men, all scholarship deep. I mean, these guys had a free ride at American universities. Women had play days. I said, what's the story? So the coach said, you can't run on the men's team. It's against the collegiate rules, but you can come out and work out with the team. You know, we would welcome you. And I said, great. Okay, I'll come out. I'll see you on the cross country course tomorrow. And he said, okay, bye. And when I left his office, this is another turning. You know how you know those moments? When I left his office and I pulled the door shut, just before the door closed, I heard him burst out laughing to his colleagues. And he said, I guess I got rid of that one. Unbelievable. I stood there for a moment, stunned and humiliated. And then what do? You show up. So I showed up. And you know what? The guys were fabulous to me. And that's when I knew running was a different sport. The coach was very surprised. He was polite. But the guy who adopted me was a volunteer coach. This is one reason why I'm very big on volunteerism. He was the university mailman and a top marathon runner in his day. But he was, by that time, pretty old. He was, in fact, ancient. He was 50. So I was 19. But he took me under his wing, and injured and broken down, this old guy ran with me every day, and he encouraged me to run distance. And we left the cross country course and went out and started doing miles on the road, which was, that just was phenomenal. It just felt like I could go forever. So that was the turning point. It was Arnie who, his name is Arnie Briggs. And it was Arnie who inspired me to do the first Boston, but that's another story. So we'll get to that in a minute, I'm sure. So that's what my early days were like.
Yes, so interesting. I think looking at the people who inspired you to run, like firstly your dad, I feel like I can relate to that a lot. I feel like my dad instilled a lot of competitiveness in me when I was quite a young girl and really drove me to love sport and threw me in the deep end at points as well. And then, you know, Arnie coming in and taking you under his wing, and how important those mentors are when you're a young girl, especially, I can only imagine, in your position where you don't have anyone else to look to or anyone else that you feel is the same as you, as in a woman runner. There wouldn't have been many of them for you to kind of be inspired or influenced by. So cool to have those male allies around you. What was it about the longer distances that got you excited? You obviously started running those longer distances. It's quite a young age. You're only 20 when you ran Boston. But I remember hearing you went out and did like a 30 mile or 48 kilometer run in the training up to Boston. Like,
what was 50 Ks actually.
Oh, yeah. What took you to those long distances?
Well, that's the next step in this story. But just getting back to influence of parents, I actually tell that story all the time when I'm giving a speech, because I want every person in the audience to realize how important just giving, you throw down all these pearls of wisdom and you don't know what the kids are going to pick up, but you just keep doing it. They'll pick up something. And my dad swears he doesn't remember even saying to me that life was to participate, not spectate. And now we're making t-shirts with it. What happened next is that, you know, I was also still quite adolescent when I was out running with Arnie. And, you know, I would bitch and whinge and say, I just did one today. He said, no, you have to run every day. You know, that's the whole point. We got to get it longer if you want to go long. And so one time, almost every run, he would tell me about the day he ran the Boston Marathon, which was he'd run it 15 times. And it was like the best day in his life. It was the day he was somebody. You know, his name was in the paper. He finished in the top 10 a couple of times. He was a big deal. And otherwise, he was a mailman who walked through the snow, you know? And so I was inspired by this enormous heart. So finally, I got tired of hearing the Boston story, actually. And I told him, you know, let's quit talking about it and just run it. And he kept just striding along. And he said, well, a woman can't run the Boston Marathon. And I said, what? And he said, oh, a woman is not capable of 42.2Ks. And I said, oh, come on. I said, we're doing 10 miles a night. He said, no. You can't. It's when you introduced me, Lydia, you actually said I was the first woman to run the Boston Marathon. I was the first woman to run with a number because that year, 66, a woman actually had run the Boston Marathon. She jumped out of the bushes, ran without a number, and so is often overlooked. Roberta Gibb, she actually did run, and she ran well. And anyway, when I told Arnie, I said, a woman has already run it. And he said, no, she didn't. She didn't do it. You know, and people just don't believe the stories. So I said, look, you got to believe, Arnie. It's some woman someplace can do this. And he said, if any woman could, I believe you could, but you'd have to prove it to me. And if you prove it to me, I would be the first person to take you to Boston. Absolutely, let's go. So I said, yeah, I'll prove it to you. And he goes, oh my God. He said, all right. He said, we're going to have to really pick this up, which means do the same workout every night, which was about an hour 15 every night. And I mean, we were slow. You got it. You know, this wasn't big mileage, all right? But on the weekends, we're going to up it, you know, up it by 2 miles every weekend type of thing. So we got to the weekend when we were going to do the 26 miles. And I was very excited. This is the big one. And we ran and we ran and we ran and we ran. And now we're coming into our finish line and Arnie's going, oh my God, you're going to do this. I can't believe it. You look great. You look great. I said, I feel great, Arnie. But I said, I don't think it's long enough. And he said, what do you mean? He said, it's long if it's anything. It's too long. I measured it. I said, no, I don't feel like we've done any 26 miles. I said, let's go for another 5 miles. So another 8K. And he goes, can you do another 8K? I said, I feel great. And he goes, oh, okay. So we went out and the last 2Ks, Arnie lost it. Eyes are gone. He's white as a sheet, weaving all over the road. And I put my arm through and say, come on, we can do it. We can do it. I pulled him along. And when we finished, I was so excited. I hit him on the back with a big hug and I said, we did it. We're going to Boston. And he fainted. He woke up, he had his head between his knees and he said, oh my God, he said, women have hidden potential in endurance and stamina. And we had discovered it, you know, that I can't go fast like the guys. The guys wouldn't come out and run with us, you know, after 20Ks. They said we were crazy people, but that's when I could keep up with them. And I think, and I know you guys are agreeing because you're endurance athletes. I mean, that's what's changing the face of our sport today. You know, they're just finishing. There are 10 women running a 6-day ultra race in Palm Springs, the further race. The women are winning the ultras. Women are bringing the team home in the Grand Traverse. You know, Jasmine Paris, for God's sake, stopping at aid stations and nursing her baby, you know. There's a reason. And I think it's a very exciting time for us. Really, really exciting time. So anyway, Arnie helped me sign up for the Boston Marathon. He brought over the entry form. I said, why do I need to sign up? Let's just go up and run. He said, no, it's a serious race. I had to get a physical from the doctor and all that kind of stuff. I submitted all this paperwork, but I signed the entry form with my initials, KV Switzer, which is how I always sign my name because my dad misspelled my name on my birth certificate. He was a highly motivating guy, but a lousy speller. And my name was always misspelled. So I started just pretending like I was J.D. Salinger or E.E. Cummings. And That's how I signed the certificate going into Boston. And it, honest to God, it was not to defraud them. I didn't want to go to Boston and say, hey, I'm here, I'm a girl. But I was not trying to fake the officials. Mm-hmm. And then the whole incident happened in Boston simply because I was given that number and I was a girl wearing it. And they thought I was being a real prankster, which is not true.
Wow. What a story. Oh,
it is a story. Amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. I just love that untapped potential line. It's like, wow, a woman can actually do this. And I just can't believe that. Yeah. It was ever believed that we couldn't, but that's the world we've sort of been brought up in. And you have obviously paved the way. I think when you were speaking just then, I started to tear up because you were like, so excited at that point when you were like, you wanted to go to Boston, you were like, let's go. And I just felt that excitement from you. And like that feeling must have been just something so special. And yeah, I just started nearly crying because I just want to say thank you for, yeah, untapping that potential for women. And yeah, you've really opened up the space for us as runners now. And yeah, we're forever grateful for you taking that risk and putting yourself out there. But yeah, if we can go a little bit deeper into the Boston race itself, and were you prepared and aware for the backlash or the potential of the backlash that was going to come, you know, alongside you entering and starting to do the marathon, and what you went through, you know, during the marathon and the race director coming up to you? Like, were you expecting that, or what was that experience like for you?
No, it was totally out of the blue. I you know, when I showed up at the starting line in Boston, first of all, the weather was diabolical. Now, I was used to this kind of weather because I was at the University of Syracuse, New York, where we had, if you can imagine it, 9 meters of snow that winter, and it's still on the ground. So I was used to sleet and cold rain and snow. And that's what happened that day at Boston. Boston can also be, you know, 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So it can be anything. It's diabolical, April, you know, anything can happen. But anyway, I had on the baggy sweatsuit and I was really disappointed because I'd worked very hard on making a really cute shorts and top outfit because, you know, women's clothing in sports just didn't exist. So I had made this really cute maroon colored top and shorts. And I wanted to look really good. I knew I was going to be noticed because I was a woman. So I decided, look good, refute the image of the ugly women take to sports because there's nothing else they can do, you know? So I said, no, we're going to try to change a little of this image. And I wanted other women to see that a girly girl could run. And, you know, we don't have to worry about all that now, which is so great. But I had to wear this baggy sweatsuit. And in fact, it was the one I was going to throw away. We were going to warm up in our stuff and then throw it away as we ran. And the officials obviously didn't notice me as a girl, but all the men did. And they were all over me, coming up to me and saying, hey, I wish you luck. I wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. They were really, really supportive. And I mean, always the men's running community has been great to me. I was going to expect maybe some backlash from the public because often when I ran, I would get hooted at, you know, on the road, and people would throw things at you. And, you know, that's, I'm sure you've been through it yourself. But at any rate, I was excited, but disappointed in the weather, but we decided to knuckle down and do it. But anyway, the race directors were very, very upset because of the weather and getting everybody to the start line on time and all that stuff. Finally, the race got off bang at noon, like it always does, or did. And the press truck in those days, if you can imagine this, was behind the runners. And so when the race started, the press truck would beep its horn and the runners had to move over, and the press truck went back through and were taking pictures backwards off the back of the truck. So it made for dramatic coverage, but it was a stupid way to organize a race. So they beeped us and we moved over, and they slowed down because they slowed down right in front because there was a girl and it was clear I was a girl, and hair was flying and boobs, you know. And then alongside of the truck came the bus with the officials and this and the scribes, the guys on their typewriters, the journalists. And the guys on the bus were teasing the race director. His name was Jock Semple. He was a feisty Scotsman. And they said, "Hey, Jocko, there's a girl in your race and she's wearing numbers." And he said, he just lost it. He very short fuse. He jumped off the bus, ran after me and grabbed me and spun me back and tried to rip the numbers, this about this size, right? Tried to rip the number off my front and I jumped back. I absolutely terrified. He was just out of the blue. And as I turned back to get away from him, he went for the one on my back and he caught the one on the corner, which is why this logo has the torn corner here. And Arnie was screaming at him, leave her alone. She's okay, Jock. I've trained her, leave her alone. But my boyfriend, which is another story, but my boyfriend was running with me. Basically, if a girl could do it, he could do it. And he was a 235-pound gridiron football player. And he hit Jock Semple with a beautiful shoulder charge, took him right out of the race, over the side of the road. And Arnie screamed, run like hell. And down the street we went. Oh, and I was crying and I was absolutely terrified, really. But telling the story is hilarious. You know, a girl being saved by burly boyfriend. And then the press on the truck hung right with me and were so aggressive, you know. And every time they'd ask me a question, which I wouldn't answer, they would say, when are you going to quit? When are you going to quit? And finally, I said, you guys better get to the start of the race because I'm not quitting, no matter what. And they drifted away. And I turned to Arnie and said, I'm going to finish this race on my hands and my knees if I have to. You know, I was just absolutely determined. So that was kind of the moment. I kind of call that my fearless moment. And we all have them. And you can decide to finish or you can walk away. And I knew if I walked away, I would only confirm everything that everybody said. Oh, she's just in it for being a clown. She's just in it for publicity. Women can't do this. Women are always barging into places where they're not welcome and they can't do it anyway. I'd heard it a million times and I knew I could do it because I did it in practice. In fact, I ran 31 miles. So anyway, dug in and you know, went on and finished the race, which is another story too.
My gosh.
There's always a lifetime in every marathon. You guys know that.
Oh, totally. I feel like every race you kind of go through so many different personalities and thoughts. And I can't even imagine what it was like for you during that race. It honestly brings, like you said, tears to my eyes and like gives me goosebumps to think about yourself, putting yourself in that position. And it must have been terrifying, but you must have just felt so much desire to go and do this thing. And I don't know if you'd say prove people wrong or just like women are incredible. And so many women knew that, I'm sure, and would have felt that. But to see someone out there like yourself actually achieving what they would have thought was impossible, you know, like it's so, so incredible. And you truly have allowed people like Esther and myself to do what we love to do. And we're so, so grateful to have people like you ahead of us paving that way. And did you feel in the moment when you were in that race and after you were approached by the officials and, you know, nearly got pulled off the course, did you feel the impact or the importance of what you were doing in the moment? Like, did you say to yourself, I need to finish this race to make sure that women in the future are able and going to have the opportunity to do this?
Absolutely. I said, if I don't do this, nobody's going to believe women can do it. But most importantly, women themselves were not believing they could do things because it had been reinforced to them for so many thousands of years that they didn't belong, that they came to believe they couldn't do things. I mean, before, you know, even after I ran the race, I was getting letters from women say, you know, you really have damaged yourself. You're never going to have children. And, you know, you're going to turn into a man. Like all these things, they don't care about now. But honestly, there was this prevailing myth that you were going to grow hair on your chest and get big legs and your uterus was going to fall out. Definitely. And then I kind of was angry at women, like about 30 Ks, you know, when you start going on to fumes, right? I forgave the race director. As I said, he's just a product of his time. He doesn't know anything else. You can't blame the guy. He's protecting his race. He's tired. He's exhausted. That's what he thinks of women. And so my job is to show him that I'm serious, okay? So, but where are the women? And I got angry at women. And for a couple of miles, I was angry at them. And I thought, then I realized, oh my God, how could I be so stupid? You know, they're not here because they're afraid. And they're afraid because they've never had an opportunity to disprove their own fear. They didn't have a dad who said, come on, honey, you can run a mile a day, or an Arnie. And yeah, did I pick up what they offered me? Yes. And a lot of times stuff, you know, you're offered goes over your head. But I said, I've got to somehow reach those women. So I knew I could change Jock Semple's mind by simply becoming a better athlete, because I was going to run a 4-hour and 20-minute marathon, perfectly acceptable now, but in those days it was a jogging time. So if I could become a better athlete, I knew I could convince the likes of Jock Semple that I was serious. But I didn't know how I was going to convince women. And the letters afterwards from women were half and half. You know, I love what you did so much, I'm putting your picture on our mantelpiece over the fireplace. You know, others were, you don't know what you've done to yourself. This was a terrible thing to do for women. You know, you're making us look disgusting. You know, you're going to fry in hell. It was always the great one from the religious right. You know, you always have some kind of religious thing about it. And, you know, I would share these things with my college roommates, and we'd throw out the cruddy ones and keep the good ones. But then as time went on, after I finished the race, I trained my brains out. And that's in a way, the easiest part of the story. I mean, not easy, the simplest, because training is hard. But I trained myself down to a 2:51 marathon. And when I did that, Jock Semple and I became best of friends. Okay. I had forgiven him. It took him 5 years. All right. And then in terms of the women, I realized finally it was going to be opportunity. And got together with other women. And there were like 4 or 5 of us who kept showing up for the Boston Marathon unofficially. And we decided we would campaign to change the rules to let women run longer distances. And finally, 5 years later, again, we were official at the Boston Marathon. And in the United States, that was 1972. So that was a pivotal year, because the United States also mandated what is called Title IX. It is an amendment to the Constitution, which mandated equality of education for women in universities and high schools, which meant women also had to have scholarships and sports teams. And I'll tell you, the male athletic establishment went berserk, because they wanted to protect their rugby and their football and their scholarships. And now they had to share that money with women. And you see the result was phenomenal. By 1984 Olympics, this is 72, but by the 84 Olympic Games, almost every single American woman on the Olympic team were products of Title IX institutions. So it made a huge deal difference. So when that was signed into law, we had just been admitted to the Boston Marathon. And so I'm not saying that we made that amendment happen, but I'm saying certainly when people saw that women were allowed to run the Boston Marathon, they suddenly realized that we should mandate the equality of the opportunity for them. So that was really huge. It really was. And of course, now people look back on that as almost really ancient history. And to me, of course, it seems like day before yesterday, not quite yesterday, but the day before yesterday. And after that, I was inspired to create the bigger opportunity, which was to get the women in the Olympic Games, in the marathon, in the Olympic Games. And I'll tell you, when I was going around getting a support, legislative support on that, they thought I was smoking weed. I'm not kidding you. They thought I was a crazy person. Oh, we can't get the marathon in the Olympic Games. Oh, no. And I decided to go the route I knew the best, which was to create an event and to create sponsorship for this event. So I worked out a very big proposal. I took it, this is a long story, but I took it to Avon Cosmetics, which at the time was the world's largest cosmetics company. Even in New Zealand, you had Avon Cosmetics. And I showed them if they sponsored the series of races for women only, that they would get enormous positive, healthful publicity, make it non-competitive, for most everybody, but competitive up front. So women who could excel would get, you know, trips, international trips, not money, because we weren't allowed to take money. But we created then a global championship marathon every year in a major city, London, Paris, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, etc. And then used the data and statistics from those races to convince the International Olympic Committee to get the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. And we were told you have to have, you know, 24 countries and three continents. You have to have medical evidence. You have to have performance indicators. We had it all. We had it all. We got doctors on board who were runners, who were doing the studies on a lot of women. And they came to the conclusion, they said, oh my God, not only are they, is it safe for women to run a marathon? They're more ideally suited for that than the hurdles or the shot put. So, you know, this is women's event. I mean, I think right now, you know, the Olympics are going to be incredible. I think it'd be great to have like a 24-hour run or a 6-day race where half the team is men, half the team is women, or all women, all men, whatever. But it adds some endurance things that go through the streets as well. Olympics don't have to be the way they always were. And finally, they are changing quite dramatically. But anyway, when that was voted in, it was one of the happiest days of my life, you know, because I knew now that the world was truly changing. I did the broadcast for that race for the networks. And afterwards, I was really kind of in the pits because although we had an incredible event and it was really one of the highlights of the 84 Olympics, I said, okay, now isn't that great for women who have the opportunity to train for the Olympics? What about all those women who aren't allowed to get an education or drive a car or go out of their house or choose their own husbands? You know, how are we going to reach them? And that's eventually, it took me a long time, but that's eventually how we created 261 with that vision.
Oh my gosh, what a journey you've been on.
It is. You know, I used to think that getting the marathon in the Olympic Games was kind of the highlight of my professional and athletic life. But you never know. Maybe it's going to be 261. You know, we're very young. We're only about 7 years old, 8 years old. We're already in 14 countries. And it's, you know, non-competitive, social, non-judgmental. We'd love everybody to come and join us. Just go to 261fearless.org. We got a great group here in Wellington and in Auckland, and we're cooking, you know, really cooking.
Oh, that's so cool to hear. We have a Femi Run community in Wellington as well. We should connect with 261.
Oh, let's do that. I didn't know that. Had no idea. Yeah,
we'll set that up. That'd be awesome.
Great, let's do it.
So cool. Yeah, it's interesting. There's two things that you said there that you. Like the highlight of your, you know, professional career or something may have been the run, which Liz and I sort of talk about this as well. Like we've had a fair bit of success in running, but we're sort of like, if we could have done what we're doing with Femi now or make it to the Olympic Games, we choose Femi because it's like so much more impactful for women coming through in sport to have like communities like that. And that we think that's so much more impactful than me or her going to the Olympic Games. Or something like that. It's just, you can have so much more impact in something that maybe you never expected.
You know, I noticed that even with our community in Wellington, I mean, you know, none of us are impoverished women, okay? But everybody loves the socialization and the community. And one woman has an extremely dynamic career and a lot of pressure. And one rainy day when we were all getting ready to go for a run, a car drove up, meow, and the doors opened and she jumped out and her husband leaned out and he said, I made her come to go out with you guys as exhausted as she is because it's the best thing, best part of her week right now to break the stress of her career. And we all cheered and it's a coffee afterwards sometimes, which is the biggest thing, you know, talking to each other.
Definitely. Yeah, that connection piece. I love that story. That's awesome. It's quite inspiring that you were able to forgive the race director during the actual marathon that happened to you, because both Liz and I talk a bit about how what we went through with the coaches you know, obviously impacted us quite negatively as athletes, but we're both not mad with them, or we don't blame them. It's you know, it's a system-wide issue. And unfortunately, they haven't, you know, been educated enough about female physiology to understand that we could actually perform at a really awesome level whilst still keeping a healthy menstrual cycle and fueling our bodies well. So yeah, we both take that same approach to the coaches, and obviously it's on a different, completely different level, but what we went through, we don't blame them for that, because it is really the system that's the problem. In your opinion, what can we all be doing better now to change the system for future generations of young women?
It's going to be not easy. And the reason being is let's say, oh, it's as simple as getting more female coaches. Well, it's not. It's like getting that education as part of the curriculum into women's physiology that is really, really critical. And it's not just the physiology. I mean, we're different in many other ways, our mental outlook and everything else. So how are we going to get a lot of people, men and women, as coaches, educated properly? So that's important. So, I mean, Lauren Fleshman and Stacey Sims and all of these women, you know, we all, maybe, I don't know, we should get together quickly and say, hey, well, you know, how are we going to work on the system and systematically go after it? I think we would be welcome, because it's becoming too hot of an international scandal of the female abuse. I mean, we need to really address that. So I'm proud of what 261 Fearless is doing, because we have a very, very strong educational component. With our coaches, and basically what we do, we have a run group, but we have a coach and another coach and another coach, at least three in each community that leads them, and they have to go through a 2-day training program, and then on a monthly basis get an educational empowerment class, and get refreshed every year. So I mean, we try to keep that up in a very big way. That doesn't replace a university education in this, okay? And I think we have to go to the highest levels as well. How do you reach women who are in a restricted situation, whether it's religious, social, custom, or domestic abuse, or sheer poverty? You know, those are huge barriers. And again, what we are trying to do with 261 Fearless is just hold out our hand and say, hey, you know, you're my next door neighbor. Why don't you come out and just have a little walk run with me, meet some women and stuff like that. Sometimes people just need a friend. It could be that simple. Other times there are other huge barriers. I mean, if a father tells his daughter, if you go out and run, I'm going to cut off your nose, like they do in Afghanistan, what's she going to do? Some of them actually do run. And they run around their little gardens again and again and again and again, because they know enough that people are out there running. There's an amazing event called the Secret 3K. Do you know about that? There's the first marathon in Afghanistan for women, and it was called the Secret Marathon. And a friend of mine went over to run it. I don't know how she got the guts to do this. I'm afraid I wouldn't do that. But anyway, she went over and took a film crew and filmed this and ran the marathon with them. And it was called the Secret Marathon because they couldn't reveal the course. There was going to be is going to be someplace. And they had a lot of Afghan men who were extremely supportive and who would run and train with the women at 4 a.m. in the dark so that they would be safe. And then they had the marathon. So it was a very emotional film. And from that has spawned something called the Secret 3K. So every year on International Women's Day, we run this 3K with these equality bibs and raise money for the Afghan community and other women who are in these desperate places to be able to go out and train. Having said that, and a couple of these, some of the money actually went to relocating some of the women to Canada, as it turned out, which was really great. This is a Canadian woman, but that's going to be a very hard nut. Because overcoming, I mean, you just look at what's going on right now between Israel and the Palestinians, for God's sakes. You know, there are thousands of years of acrimony and hatred. And how are you going to overcome this stuff? And it defies common sense, actually, because it's so visceral and emotional. And protection of women in the family or ownership of women is very, very difficult. So we've got to work on that one. Fortunately, running is easy, cheap, and accessible. So that's a bonus for us.
Yeah, you're doing some incredible work, both as an individual and with 261 Fearless. It's really inspiring to see the change that you're driving through the work that you're doing. And Esther and I regularly talk about running being our voice for change and really like leaning on our voice that we've been able to grow through the running that we've been doing our entire lives. And we feel somewhat of a responsibility, and it's a big reason why we started FEMI was to take that responsibility we felt because we had a voice to allow women to learn about their bodies, you know, through our channels. And it feels like there are so many similarities. I think the degree that you're working on is driving probably even more change than what we're doing at FEMI, but there are so many similarities between the two, which is awesome. And we're just like, yeah, so grateful for the work that you're doing to get more women running.
Hey, let me just say one quick thing, Lydia, that you just said, is we felt responsible. You know, that's how I have felt my whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, running has given me personally so much self-esteem and strength and empowerment. And you know, it's given me everything. It's given me my husband, my religion, my home, my travel, my career. But it's given me me. Yeah. And every day I run, I've got me. And so I feel terribly responsible, like you guys, for passing that on. And I'm so glad you chose that word. People say to me, how did you feel when you crossed the finish line of the Boston Marathon in 1967? Well, I felt really responsible. I said, you know, I've stepped in this now. What am I going to do with it? I've really got to pass this on. And there you go.
Wow. That was
so gonna... thank you guys.
My next question was around, yeah, like kind of what drives you to drive for change? You know, it's obviously so important to you. And I think you kind of answered it there, that running has impacted you so much and you feel like you need to pass it on to others. And it's exactly how we feel too.
Yeah, good. And if we can instill that in others, but I think, you know, I think any woman who runs and has the community that we have been all lucky now to have, you know, for better or worse, we've had some bad community as well. You guys, especially, because there was no competition for me when I was younger. I mean, I didn't have to make a team or I didn't have an Olympic opportunity. So I'd missed all that. And you guys are the products of that now. For better or worse, you certainly learned a lot, but you at least had the opportunity to make a team and to represent your country or your city or whatever. So I'm envious of that, but I'm also, you know, grateful for what I've had.
Totally. Yeah, we are lucky, and yeah, it's just such different environments that we've all been able to get into running in, right? And like the world has actually changed so much and the last 40, 50 years for women's sport. Obviously, we've still got a long way to go, but it has been pretty exciting to see the change in, you know, sponsorship and money and media and attention that women deserve in sport. And I think the Women's World Cup last year was a great example of that. But
fabulous.
Oh, so good. How does that make you feel, like seeing things like this actually start to happen and see the tides changing? I know you've been through a lot of it, but like to see that these women are actually starting to get the support that they have deserved for a really long time.
I'm honest to God, I was in America when the, for a variety of reasons, normally I'm here then, but when the World Cup came here, eating my heart out. So I was getting up at 4 a.m. and watching the games and seeing the ones out of Wellington, you know, which is really exciting. Yeah, it was huge for me. So there are two things. One is, well, the team I was cheering hardest for was Morocco. And when they came through and started winning, and I mean, they had a chance to be in the finals, I think, didn't they? Didn't they get almost close, semifinals, whatever? And the coach was crying and the women were crying. And I thought, see, this is the thing. It's on global television. And for better or worse, TV has been unbelievable. I mean, you see the pictures. Part of my fame is because of the pictures, you know, of those dramatic pictures, which have been so iconic. They drag them out every year, you know, International Women's Day. And they make videos of them and stuff. And it's huge. So media is extremely important. So I was very, very excited about that. Also, Women's World Cup rugby when it was here. How about that in one weekend changing the attitude of New Zealand men with rugby and women playing? I mean, they were unbelievable. You couldn't believe it. Oh, jeepers. But the other thing is the fact that the discovery now of women's endurance, and it's changing the capability and mindset of people, and how that is going to be changing attitudes very, very quickly. And how we have to be excited about this change, because when you look at the history of sports, men have had an Olympics, for example, for about 3,000 years. Women have really only been running and had an Olympics with running for the last 60 years, 50, 60 years. Women were admitted into the Olympic Games in 1928, and then they pulled the running, long distance running events until 1960, because they were shocked by the supposed exhaustion of the women, which is actually a fabrication. My husband, Roger Robinson, has written about that in his latest book, which is Running's Greatest Stories. And that, in fact, was probably a jack-up by the IOC to get women's events out of the Olympic Games. Scandalous. Anyway, so you look at the progress we've made in the last 50 years, let's say, since I ran the Boston Marathon, for example. It's astronomical. And so if the next 50 years are like that, I mean, it's going to be something. And it probably will be. And I can't tell you what it's going to look like, but I think it's going to be huge. And I think it's going to involve the third world. And I think a lot of us women are going to make that happen.
Yeah, it's incredibly exciting to think about where we're going to be.
But you guys are on the cutting edge now. See, you're taking the baton. You're running with this. Great.
Yes, well, we couldn't have been doing this and be in the position we are in without people like yourself. So I feel like I've said thank you so many times in this episode, but honestly, we are so grateful for you. Every time I see that iconic photo of you being pulled off the Boston Marathon, it just like really inspires me to keep digging and keep driving. And Esther and I feel a lot of pressure that what we're trying to achieve at FEMI, both as female founders of a tech company, as well as leading a community of women and being female athletes, it is tough and it is hard. Like, I understand we have a lot of privilege and that's why we feel this responsibility, but it's incredibly hard at what we're trying to achieve. So yep. Having people like yourselves, you know, pave that way. And then I personally feel responsible for you, like to be able to make justice of what you've been able to do for us and make the most of that opportunity. So yeah, I'm going to start crying now, but we're so grateful.
Well, don't cry, because you've got a lot of work ahead of you. But you know what? It's very, very worthwhile work. Although, you know, it's so frustrating when somebody doesn't get it, when it's so clear to us. But I think people are getting it. And we're going to see some horrific stuff again in the third world, but we can make huge positive change now. I know we can. Yeah. It's going to be exciting.
Very exciting. Well, thank you. And thank you so much, yeah, for your time today. We were so excited when we heard we were able to speak with you, and hopefully we can get you back on the podcast, you know, in another
sure. Yeah.
That's from you. But yeah, we know our community are going to absolutely love this conversation. So we'll tag Catherine into our show notes and tag 261 Fearless into our show notes so our community can go and check out all the goodness that Catherine does. But if you want to get in touch with us, you can head to our Instagram at femi.co or slide into me and Esther's DMs. But yeah, thank you so much, Catherine. Really appreciate you.
You're so welcome. And I have a very funny feeling we're going to be seeing a lot of each other. You'll be great. Thank you guys for making the connection. I'm really grateful to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay.